and welcome to Dialect. I'm Tony Gosling. Dialect is Bristol's first podcast, set up in 2002 and goes out every Friday afternoon at 2pm on BCFM 93.2. This week, Angela Ossett's in from Bristol Older People's Forum. She talks about being a teacher in London in the 1970s. Paul Fernie's in again this week on our tour of the solar system. Saturn, I think, is our stop. We start this week with Sabine McNeil from victimsunite.net. Hi, Sabine. Welcome to Dialect.
Hi, Tony.
Now, the Bilderberg Conference. I'm going to be talking about it again in a little while, but what's your take on this? This has got a lot of news coverage, actually, this week, and over the weekend, probably more than ever in the British press at a Bilderberg meeting. So what's your take? I mean, you're coming at it also, like me, in a way, as a sort of European. I'm looking at it from a British point of view, and you as a German.
Yes, I really loved your interview, Tony, with the British perspective, but I also was very much alerted to something that nobody else seems to have picked up so far in the Anglo-Saxon world, the strategic choice of locations. On the German blog, I found that after the Washington meeting, the Lehman Brothers fell to pieces. After the Athens meeting, the Greek debt crisis emerged. After a meeting in Switzerland joined the Euro Club, supposedly. So the choice of the UK as a location in Germany was interpreted as the, if you like, gap between the UK, between the Eurosceptics and the Europhiles. And that was quite significant because some of the UKIP people seemed to pick that up. The other terribly important thing is that it is definitely a policy summit. There's this delightful person who put in FOI requests regarding George Osborne's, and the 12-page response that he got basically revealed that, yes, policy is being made there.
Yes,
and
I think you're talking...
ultimately...
Yeah, you're talking, I think, about Jake Bex. It's just... I mean, this just shows you just how one person doing a little bit of research and asking the right questions can make a massive difference, because Jake has proved the Bilderberg people are lying. I suppose I better... Really, for people that have never heard about these conferences, they started after World War II. They're made up mostly of bankers, who we already know through HSBC, UBS, Barclays, etc., have been actually committing massive fraud and money laundering, payment protection insurance fraud, interest rate swap fraud, and billions have been defrauded. And yet none of these people, actually the directors and the senior people in these banks, have gone to jail. We've also got in these Bilderberg conferences a secret ring of steel around them, royalty, the media. Up until recently, Rupert Murdoch's chief executive went to these meetings, plus a smattering of politicians, up and coming politicians, people who seem to be magically, just after they come to one of these conferences, get into power. I mean, for example, a leader of an opposition who maybe a couple of years later will become the prime minister, invited along too. The other thing is there are actually journalists from magazines like the Financial Times and the Economist, as well as members of parliament. And when they go into these meetings, they swear an oath of secrecy that they will never tell, under Chatham House rules, what they've heard inside.
Yes, that's exactly what I found out in 1996 when I was given a German book called The Secret Society, or Secret Societies, and I was completely shocked that the editor of one of my favorite German weekly papers had also been invited and gone to these Bilderberg meetings. The fact that they are policymakers and kingmakers is clearly key. It seems that there is like a kernel of power that then attracts those who love to be attracted by power, and who kind of bathe in it. What I found incredibly interesting is that Kenneth Clark, his role became so apparent thanks to the email that you sent about the discussion in the House of Commons. Kenneth Clark was the Minister of Justice to whom we had submitted our four biggest fraudulent bankruptcies some time ago, and of course we didn't get anywhere. And now he is, of course, the big person being accused by Ben Fellows as well. And then he conveniently forgets his mega role in the Bilderberg organization of meetings.
That's right. I mean, it's amazing to see 20 minutes of discussion in the House of Commons this week about it as well, which is available online. If you want to look at YouTube, you can watch that again. Actually quite interesting. But Ken Clark is definitely a key figure. He's on the steering committee. Now, I mean, you're dealing with miscarriages of justice, but I put it to you, Sabine, that Ken Clark is going to make things far worse even than you have happened to be dealing with over the last decade. He's doing things like destroying legal aid, effectively putting G4S in charge of legal aid, where you'll be allocated a legal aid lawyer by G4S. And of course, then there's a vested interest in giving you a duff lawyer, a bad lawyer, because G4S will be profiting not only from possibly from the privatised prison if you're incarcerated and you lose your case, but they will also be most definitely carting you around in the Black Mariahs, which are now privatised. And they actually will make a profit if they give you a bad lawyer. So this is all being brought in actually by Chris Grayling, but it's the Justice Secretary, but it's actually something which was started by Ken Clark. Now, not only that, we've also got secret courts. The extension, I mean, we know, for example, with child protection and things like that, there have been secret courts for quite a while. But the extension of that to the security services and other, you know, crimes to do with national security. So, you know, Ken doesn't really come out of well out of this. And what do you think it's going to do for you know, for your efforts, Sabine, and for justice generally? You know, your website, victimsunite.net, it could be that you actually have more cases that you need to help.
Well, we do have already, that's for sure. We can't help anybody and everybody who comes along and leaves a comment or leaves a message. I mean, after all, we are all volunteers, and we are not that many either. So victims need to help each other, but it's very clear that I met a person today in Holloway, and she also said, if I had known after I'd been incarcerated, if I had known what I knew earlier, I would never have gone into prison. So it is an incredibly steep learning curve that people have to go through, and the big question is whether lawyers are or are not reliable. I mean, why is there a website called Solicitors from Hell? Because most of them aren't. And what that we have certainly found, if I mean, by now I can only hope that the one family lawyer that we found is actually trustworthy. There are maybe one or two others around, but I just feel they are so much part of the system, i.e. their livelihood depends on being paid and by G4S. So at the core is the money system, and that spreads into the legal system as the method to control. And so the law enforcement is the outer ring, and to hell with everybody who can't survive within that system.
But nobody would deny that there are problems with the financial system. You know, why shouldn't the courts be privatised? Because they're talking about that too. Ken Clark's department, or what was the Justice Department, now run by Chris Grayling, Conservative Justice Secretary, they're talking about privatising the courts. Already here in Bristol Crown Court, sometimes they have days where towards the end of the month they've run out of money, they can't pay people, the court has to shut down. So surely it's time to privatise it if we're running out of money in the current system.
Well, why whether money comes from a privatised source or from a public source, the ultimate betrayal or treason is of course the whole money system in the first place, and money for public services and the public interest is part of the symptoms. But privatization is clearly not an answer. But if people think it is, it's just part of the overall trend of when corporations rule the world, so that there is no accountability, that nobody is accountable, and that there is no sense of nationality anymore, and that the society that ultimately is only run by those who happen to have a job in these corporations, and the passive shareholders are the ones who benefit and who pull the strings.
Tyranny could come in all sorts of ways, but I mean, mm-hmm. certainly as you privatise, then so all of those services that you're privatising become at arm's length from government. It
yes.
means that the vote means less.
Yes. And the only thing that counts is the penny, is the dollar, is the pound. And that's why ultimately, of course, the the big fear is the one world currency that the New World Order is aiming towards. And I can assure you that the Bilderbergers are the major operation in with which to enforce that.
But they're not going to get that, Sabine, are they? Because they've got to deal with the Chinese, who are obviously another power bloc, and the Russians, amongst others.
Well, yes, thank God. But the one world currency may come along as in its disguise via all of these multinationals. But at the same time, let's just, I mean, as long as there's life, there's hope. I'm singing with Edith Piaf, you know.
Okay, Sabine, victims-unite.net. Thanks very much for joining us.
You're most welcome, Tony. Keep going.
And you. Bye.
Thank you, Tony.
Goodbye.
Bye. Bristol Community FM 93.2.
Your voice, your choice. Now I'm joined by Angela Ossett from Bristol Older People's Forum. Hi, Angela, and welcome to Dialect.
Thank you.
First of all, what is the Older People's Forum?
It's a forum of 2,800 older Bristolians. You have to be over 55 to join. We have a grant from the Community Development Department of Bristol City Council. We employ a part-time worker and we have a management committee. We meet 12 times a year, most 10 of those in Broadmead Baptist Church, two of them, one in Eastern Community Centre, and one in the Malcolm X Centre. We identify some issues that we're going to campaign on. And this year they are, just looking down and seeing, public transport and the bus pass, cycling and safety on pavements, that's one. Health and social care, including NHS privatisation. The third one's pension and benefits. Those are the three main ones, and we have a continuing campaign because we found from our last survey that over 1,000 of our nearly 3,000 members have no access to the internet. And what we're finding is they're more and more shut out of life in the city.
I notice on this station, actually, quite often you'll say, someone will come on and say, oh, well, if you want to find out more, go to www. Well, what you've just said, a third of older listeners may not have no internet at all.
Absolutely. And so, more and more, even doctor's surgeries now, if you want to make a quick appointment, you're probably better off going online than trying to ring up at 8 o'clock in the morning.
Yeah, do you think some older people feel that they're being sort of forced into this against their will, this internet thing?
I think there's a difference. I think a lot of people want to get online, they want to own a computer, but they're really frightened about the costs. It's not just the cost of buying the computer, but it's the cost of access to broadband, even extra electricity. I mean, I think pensioners have found the last couple of years really hard, and there's probably more cuts to come.
So it's really more to do, you think, with budgeting?
I think so.
Than technophobia or Luddism?
I don't think Luddism. The City Council does have a small project of selling refurbished computers at very low cost to people that wouldn't otherwise be able to afford them, and giving them training.
The other thing is, of course, if you get the right kind of equipment, one person with a broadband connection can share it between four or five households. I don't know if older people do that. It's certainly feasible.
I think there's places like care homes, for instance, that is eminently possible, and a lot of older Bristolians do live in care homes. I think with older Bristolians who perhaps, because of increasingly poor health, are more or less housebound, that's not possible. I mean, there's no doubt about it, as far as I'm concerned, that if you've got a computer, you've got access to the world. And one of the things, if I can slightly change the subject, Bristol Older People's Forum are always involved in helping organise the Celebrating Age Festival, which is about to happen. It's 24th of June for 2 weeks. And we have one day at City Hall. That's the 29th of June. And we are going to have a big session on trying to encourage older people to see what the advantages of having access to the internet. The big thing, of course, is Skype. you know, a lot of us have got grandchildren in different cities or in different countries. Skype brings them home to you.
I have a bit, lot of sympathy, though, with people that don't particularly want to be on the internet. I find it's the web, you can get stuck in it, can't you?
Oh, yeah, yeah. I think yes, and I think for some people, things like internet banking is quite frightening in case they do the wrong thing. I think a lot of my generation who are on the web, who use it, who buy coach tickets and things like that, actually would avoid Facebook and Twitter and tweeting. That's a step beyond for us.
Yeah, and but I think the banking thing really is that, you know, it's something. It seems to be moving further and further away from the personal touch, doesn't it? Mm. I mean, I can remember when. What am I, 51? I can remember when they first, these hole-in-the-wall things first appeared. I think it was probably in the late 70s, early 80s, thinking, this is a bit strange. I mean, you don't actually talk to anybody. You just press this button. Yeah. And I mean, in a way, internet banking is the ultimate faceless kind of contact to do with your money. The other thing is, what you're doing, of course, is people are getting sacked because you're not actually doing it. There's no one doing the job. It's just a sort of bald interface between one computer and another computer, or you as a person. Going back to your Bristol Older People's Forum, you were saying you discuss these issues, you campaign on these issues. Mm-hmm. But what do you actually do? Because the danger is it could be all these great discussion, the elders of the city saying, we know this is what we need to be doing, this is what we need to be changing, and then nothing happens.
Well, can I just be specific? Take a couple of the campaigns that have been of interest to us in this last year. One of our members, it wasn't specifically a BOPF campaign, one of our members, Ruth, met someone waiting for a pedestrian crossing who was in crutches, and so she got chatting to her and found out that this woman had been knocked down by a cyclist cycling on the pavement. And she started a campaign really to educate cyclists about the dangers to older people of cycling willy-nilly on the pavements. And it was taken up by Bristol Older People's Forum. We had a meeting in February, I think it was, at the Malcolm X Centre, when we had 85 people. And the community police were there, and they took it up in my neighbourhood. They asked us to identify a couple of streets where we thought there was a lot of cycling on pavements. And I live off the Gloucester Road, and that is a nightmare sometimes. And the community police actually did go out in the Gloucester Road for a bit and talk to cyclists.
They don't arrest them then?
Well, it is illegal, and you can be fined £30, but that's not the point. What we want cyclists to realise is that if you come up behind us and ring the bell, we might not hear you, because older people sometimes have hearing loss. We might not see you. We might not be able to get out of the way very quickly. So what we want is cyclists to dismount on the pavement and walk. And I have noticed, I was in Kent visiting my family recently, and I noticed in a lot of towns there seem to be a lot more notices on the pavement saying, cyclists, dismount on the pavement. And I think, although the City Council did listen to us, the community police did listen and did take up the issue, and so did the Post, I think that the City Council's got a lot more work to do in actually perhaps having more notices around the city. And more, I mean, there are shared pavement areas, you know, and again, I noticed in Kent there are quite a lot of shared pavements. There was a picture of a bike and then a big, thick white line, and then a picture of two footsteps, so you knew without being told which part of the pavement was yours and which was the cyclist's. And that seems to me to be, you know, that we can influence, and that's what we aim to do, to influence. Take another issue that is our members get passionate about, and that's the bus pass. Last summer we asked people to tell us what they thought of the bus pass, what they used it for. And a lot of people said, well, it's my lifeline. It keeps me sane. It keeps me out of the house. Even if I just go to the shops, I'm out of the house. I'm with people. So there is, you know, there are people who seem to think that wealthy pensioners are using a bus pass, I can assure you if someone's got a car, they're not going to be wanting a bus pass. You actually have to fill in a form to get a bus pass. So all of us who have a bus pass have it because we applied for it, because we need it and we use it. So we're continuing with that. And in fact, our chair, Judith, has written an article about it in one of the community journals that goes to the Southwest region. And in addition, she put an e-petition online, got 5,000 signatures, gave it to her MP, and her MP reported in Parliament. So it's actually on recorded in Hansard. So that's trying to influence, trying to make people aware of what the needs of older people are. So it's not just a talk shop. We do try to think, how can we influence the city council or even the government?
So are there any issues on which politicians or other decision makers have actually invoked the wrath of the Older People's Forum, and you know, that you've found that you've had to really push a little bit harder?
Well, I think a lot of people have signed petitions when the new legislation about the NHS was going through. I think we campaigned, we went to various high streets on a Saturday morning in different parts of the city, Knowle, Shirehampton, Southmead, and we had petitions, and people, older people, younger people, were queuing up to sign them. Well, you can't say anyone listened to us, but there were. It was part of a big campaign.
Well, certainly the government might not have done. Why the NHS, you know, why is that so important to you?
Well, it is a fact of life that when you're older, you do tend to have more health problems. And statistically, the biggest users of the health service tend to be older people, particularly in the last 10 or 15 years of life. So it's, and we've grown up with it. And we actually have, I'm in my 70s, you know, we have parents who knew what it was like before the war when there wasn't an NHS. So there's kind of folk memories that my generation have about what the world was like before the NHS. And I've lived in the States. And, for example, I mean, a long time ago, it was when Kennedy was assassinated. But my husband and I had a friend and he broke his leg. That was fine. He worked for a big company and he had good health insurance, and so he was covered. But the next year he had problems with that broken leg and it had to be rebroken, and he wasn't covered. So he had to stay at home with no salary, with no health insurance that was valid, while his wife had to go and, I think she chopped chicken livers in a deli. That's the only job she could get, and he had to look after two children under four.
A bit worrying to think that even in this country we might end up with a state where you have an accident of some sort, maybe quite serious, or someone's in a rather seriously ill condition, and an ambulance turns up and says, well, where's your insurance certificate?
Well, that is a concern. And I do think you have to keep your eye on what's happening. And sometimes there are rumours that are unsubstantiated. There was a rumour that was suggesting that there might be a limit placed on the number of times that someone could have access to an NHS doctor. That is certainly the case of what happens in the States. If I can go back to my own experience, I went to America and I'd had cystitis. So when I got a job, and I got medical insurance, I was covered for everything except anything that happened to my kidneys. What was more likely to happen if you have cystitis, you're more likely to have something happen to your kidneys.
That sounds a bit perverse, doesn't it? That anything that was actually wrong with you when you started the job, you're not covered for it.
That was America. That's health insurance. The NHS, the sacred adage is free at the point of need, and we all pay for it. You know, it's not free, we pay for it out of national insurance.
Anyway, Angela, you spent a lot of your earlier years in London, didn't you, as a teacher in the inner city. Tell us what that was like.
Well, I don't really believe in a golden age, but when I look back on my teaching career, I was a teacher of young children, the 3-year-olds to 7-year-olds. And later on, I came here and taught undergraduates, the over 18s. I think what I liked about working with the IAEA was they talked about the education service.
Okay, hang on. What was this, the ILEA?
Yeah, the Inner London Education Authority. At the time, the largest education authority in the world. And when Margaret Thatcher abolished the GLC, at the same time she abolished the ILEA, which had given me a very, very good career.
So, I mean, I can, as a Londoner myself, brought up in London, I can remember these ILEA buses going around, I seem to think. Was it either ferrying children or maybe special needs kids from one school to another? But what was good about that? I mean, that they were your employers, obviously, so you're going to like them. They're giving you a living. But how was that different to what succeeded it, what Mrs. Thatcher, once Thatcher abolished it?
I think, well, it's a long time ago, I think that career development, there were courses that you could go to at teacher centres near where your school was, where you could update your expertise. So when you qualified, there was a 1 year when you had a course once a fortnight, I think, which was giving you an introduction to the skills you needed for classroom management, for all of the subject areas that you needed to teach. And then after that, there were courses that you could choose to develop your expertise further.
And what are your thoughts about the techniques of teaching? Because obviously you're teaching the younger children. You've got to be quite careful that it's not all academic, a bit of play in there. You know, what were you doing in those days? And,
I think the reason I went into teaching as a mature student, I was married with a couple of children, and it was the playgroup movement which actually interested me in teaching, because when I left school, there was no way I wanted ever to go into a school again. I think the big influence on the ILEA at the time was a report by the Plowden Commission called The Education of the Whole Child. And that was what is very different from now. I think you were looking at, yes, the child's academic progress, particularly with young children developing literacy, beginning to read, beginning to write, but also moral education, aesthetics, physical development, emotional development, the whole child.
What about moral development? That's a bit of an awkward one, isn't it? Teaching a child right from wrong. Now, I wonder if that's an easy thing to decide. This is right and this is wrong. Nowadays, it seems to be a bit more blurred.
Well, I think that by law, a school has to have an assembly every day. And as a head teacher, I didn't have any religion per se in that assembly, because I had all religions and none. I was a head teacher in Hackney. My school was small, but there were 12 different languages. There were different kinds of Christians. There were atheists, there were Buddhists, there were Muslims. So the whole of the assembly was really moral education, learning to live together. Being nice to each other, really, is moral education for the young child, is being nice to each other, learning to share, learning to listen.
And how did you cope with the parents of, I mean, I suppose the children too may have found English difficult, lots and lots of different languages?
Well, the 12 different languages, yes. I think what people need to appreciate is that the young human being, by the time they come to school, they've mastered a language. Some of the children who came to my school had mastered more than one language. If they hadn't mastered English and they came to my school at 3, by 7, I would almost guarantee that they would be able to interpret for their mums. The biggest community, linguistic community in my school was Turkish Cypriot. And there was a Turkish community they had, I suppose you'd call them sweatshops, where the people were employed. So they didn't need, the children didn't need to speak English till they came to school. So they spoke Turkish. And I can think of specific children that you know, I sat in my office with their mum, age 7, and they had to speak and help their mum understand what I was wanting to say.
How did the multicultural thing work? Because you've got all sorts of different cultures there, I suppose different values, different ideas from different parts of the world. Did it all work in the mix?
I think I've never came across a mother that didn't want better for her children than she had. But they had different ways of doing it. Now, there were some groups of parents that were very strict with their children and would hit them if they didn't read accurately, but knew it was wrong. I think the most successful thing I did when I was ahead was call on County Hall's interpreter services. And I had, because I had quite a few different linguistic groups, I had an interpreter for 7 different groups at different times, and so the parents came, they had an interpreter, they could ask me whatever they wanted. And in actual fact, quite often they were asking about social problems, about issues outside the school. But it didn't matter, it was an opportunity for them to find out how we did things, because we were very progressive, I suppose you could say, particularly compared with some of the communities where the cane was normal and hitting children. And the attitude of some of the parents in the school was, well, how will the children obey you if you don't hit them, or if they know you won't hit them? So we had a lot of education to do with the parents.
I mean, nowadays, it seems quite a lot of education is to do with vocational stuff, you know, getting children ready for employment, jobs, those sorts of skills. Do you think that it's moving in the right direction? And, you know, what changes have you seen?
Well, I think that a job, looking for a job and preparation, I think there needs to be in secondary schools preparation for citizenship, understanding how democracy works, understanding how you vote, why you vote, you know, how laws are made.
If you vote, I mean, a lot of people out there that think, well, there's just no point anymore because, well, the Labour Party, for example, is coming out with these conservative policies. I don't want to be too political with you, but no. I mean, you know, we've had this just this last week. We've had capping benefits from the Labour Party. We've had means testing pensioners from the Labour Party. Now, mm-hmm. these are conservative policies, yeah. And you can understand why people might think, well, sorry, Angela, no point in voting, is there?
Well, what I'd like to see here is what happens in Australia. If you are registered to vote, by law, you have to vote. There are going to be people in Parliament who are going to make laws. And if you don't vote, you have opted out of influencing at all. And it seems to me that if you had to vote, maybe people would take more interest in politics.
Generally speaking, what do you think of Michael Gove, Education Secretary now? You know, what? Because there's a lot of teachers. I mean, I think they had a vote, didn't they, at the National Union of Teachers conference recently, and voted no confidence in him.
I would be voting no confidence with him.
Why?
Well, I think today, for instance, he announced a big overhaul of GCSEs and a move towards testing at the end of the course rather than course assessment. Now, my personal view is, and I have an 18-year-old grandson who's going to be studying maths at university, and he's quite clear the difficult part of his A-level course and his GCSEs has been his coursework. He's really good at passing exams. He's learnt how to do it, but he thinks that understanding comes through coursework, and I'd support him in that. And also, the OECD tests or international tests on maths and science, which compare nations. I think in 2011, when I was teaching in China, the results came for yeah, for 2011. And Shanghai had came top. It was the first time that the city of Shanghai had entered its pupils for maths and science. And it said it had become really good at teaching students by completely changing the curriculum, completely updating the teachers in what they called modern methods, which is cooperation, project work, discussion, and moving away from traditional teaching methods, which I understand Gove is quite keen on, coming away from rote learning, which I have heard Gove support. So for the city of Shanghai, modern methods, cooperation, coursework was what allowed them to achieve the best in the world in 2011 for maths and science.
Well, this rote learning, for people who aren't familiar with it, is just repeating things, yeah. Is it? The yeah. teacher says something, the children repeat it, yeah. the teacher says yeah. something. And, yeah. and are they actually, do they have to memorise it, or is it read from a book, or exercise book, or whatever?
It's memorising, and I think that some people would argue that it's pointless. Certainly, I've taught a lot in undergraduate education, undergraduate students in Guangzhou, and one thing they like about our course was that it's opportunity to discuss and to develop what they call critical thinking, what I call critical thinking. And they tell me that they have spent their education system rote learning, and I noticed that outside the library in this state university in Guangzhou, there are people holding up a book and learning it by heart. And that's what China is trying to move away from. And I feel very sad if Michael Gove is wanting us to come back to what he sees maybe as a mythical golden age which has never existed.
It sounds a bit like reading, almost like you're reading a dialogue in a play, and you're trying to remember your textbooks like that. I mean, is that something that used to happen quite a lot in Britain?
Well, I got a pass in Latin O level, and one of the books that we had to translate was the first 24 chapters of Caesar's Gallic War. Now, I had an extremely good memory, and I wasn't good at Latin. I learnt by rote the translation that we had worked on in class. And my only fear was that when I got the passage, I would continue translating beyond what the passage was for me to do as an unseen translation. In other words, I did it. I passed the exam by rote learning. The day after that, I think I would not have been able to use Latin or read Latin at all. That's rote learning.
That's right.
For me.
I mean, you know, I have to confess, Angela, when I was doing A-levels, physics and maths and things like this, I did kind of 2 or 3 weeks of absolute cramming for them. And then a lot of the stuff, I couldn't tell you now, you know, but I mean, I think, you know, certain important things I think are useful in journalism, like statistics and nuclear physics is quite, I've kept, but a lot of it you just do forget, don't you?
Yeah, and I think doing coursework, if you're doing, having to do a project over a period of weeks, of course it depends what your teacher requires of you, but if the teacher is requiring you to think, and recently I helped one of my granddaughters with her English, and I was quite impressed at the kind of thinking and analysis that she was being required to do with, I can't remember which novel she was reading, but it was really looking at issues like plot, character, giving her opinion but supporting it by looking at the text. Now that is thinking, and that's what we as a society need. This is what workers need to be able to think. They need to be able to work in teams. They need to be able to cooperate. And those are the kinds of skills that actually there was a diploma program that was going to start in 2010 for the 50% of the secondary age pupils that weren't likely to be able to go to university. And one of the first things the new government did was to cancel that programme. Now, I was a school governor at the time, and the pilot was running in several schools in Bristol, and it seemed to me to be very exciting. It seemed to me that, you mentioned earlier, preparing students for the workforce, that seemed to me to be the kind of preparation you need. Being able to think, being able to work together, being able to work on a project, being able to think. That's what society needs, I think, and I'm not convinced that Gove's ideas are going to result in a future population that is going to be able to think and to be effective workers in the 21st century.
China, fascinating place, I imagine, to visit. What were your impressions? How different is it to Britain?
Has the best food in the world. I was in Guangzhou. I suppose I worked there about 20 times. I went there 20 times. We'd teach for about 3 weeks, and then I'd have a week when I could go on holiday, have a little trip. The first time I went was 2004, and the last time was 2011. And the street on either side of the university, which was absolutely huge, was completely transformed. There were no big hotels near the university, and there were four huge ones, finished, and, you know, full of visitors. So the pace of change, that if they're building something in China, it's 24/7, it's neon lights and people are working three shifts. I don't think I would like the kind of working conditions that I think many Chinese people have.
Well, I mean, we think of it as a sort of a bit of an autocratic place. Did you feel that?
Yes. Well, I was teaching educational management. That was one of the modules, and I learnt that every Chinese state school has a Communist Party secretary who's high up in the hierarchy, and I could never get my students to decide whether that person was at the same level as the principal, higher than the principal, or lower than the principal. You can think of the control that a country has if they have that kind of person. It would be the equivalent, I suppose, in the Victorian era, there would almost always be a vicar as part of the school board. It's a very, very similar, I think. And I understand, I don't know this, but I understand that students would be invited to become members of the Communist Party, and they would pick the elite. So there's a lot of control.
Looking into the future, do you think education in this country is going to do reasonably well? I know you've already said that you're not that keen on Mr. Gove's changes, but I think it's something that we all care about as citizens, you know, the future for our youngsters. Do you see any light at the end of the tunnel?
Well, I've got three teenagers, grandchildren, and certainly, as I've already said, my grandson is hoping to go to university this October. And he's taken for granted that he will be paying an extra tax. You know, the 9,000 a year will build up. I think that will be very off-putting for families where perhaps parents are unemployed. The thought of their child taking on board that kind of debt. And I think also the EMA grant used to keep quite a lot of youngsters in school. I think we need... I'm the daughter of an engineer, and I think we don't have enough apprenticeships. We don't value engineering in the way that, for example, Germany does, where they make things continually. We've stopped doing that, and I think there always has to be hope, but I think we need sea changes. We need to take much more seriously how we educate those students that are not going to go to university, so that they have worthwhile jobs that use the skills they have.
The frustration is, I mean, maybe Britain will go down the same road as Spain, where they've got a tremendous young, well-educated population, but there, when they come out of that education, it's very difficult to find any work.
That is the big problem at the moment, finding, you know, are there jobs at the end of schooling or the end of university even? I think that's the big question of the next 10 or 15 years.
Well, lovely talking to you, Angela Ossett. Thanks very much for joining us on Dialect.
Thank you.
And if you want to find Bristol Older People's Forum online, go to www.bopf.btck.co.uk. That's bopf.btck.co.uk. I sound almost as if I wasn't listening to myself or Angela just now, because I've just given you a website, but of course you can contact the forum in a more regular fashion by snail mail, care of Age UK Bristol, Canningford House, 38 Victoria Street, or you can telephone in the old-fashioned way, 0117 927 9222. That's 927 9222.
Bristol Community FM 93.2. Your voice, your choice.
Now time to talk to Paul Fernie. Hi, Paul. Welcome to Dialect.
Hi, Tony.
I say every week. I think you're quite used to it now. We're at Saturn on our little trip around the solar system this week.
We are.
Whereabouts in the solar system? We just did Jupiter and asteroids and Jupiter's moons, but this is just outside.
Yeah, this Saturn's the sixth planet from the Sun in the solar system, and it's actually twice as far from the Sun as Jupiter is, so we're moving quite well out into the solar system now.
How far is that?
You've asked me. The distance from the Sun is 885,904,700 miles.
Okay, 900 million miles-ish.
Yeah, yeah, I mean, the Earth's 92 million miles, so you can see there's a huge...
Right, so 10 times further. This is 10 times further out from the Sun than the Earth is.
Yes. So, yeah, we're quite a distance now.
Saturn's the ringed planet, isn't it? This is the only one, I think, that's got rings. Maybe there are others with little rings, but Saturn's got some real whoppers, hasn't it?
Yeah, Saturn's one of its most well-known features are its rings. It is possible that the rings are made up of the remains of a moon that was smashed apart millions of years ago. Just to give you some idea, the diameter of Saturn is 74,898 miles versus the Earth, which is 7,926 miles.
About 10 times. So it's 10 times further than from the Sun, and it's also 10 times larger.
Or yes. At least
its diameter is 10 times more.
Yeah, you could fit the Earth across it 10 times, effectively. But the rings actually take the diameter out to 155,000 miles. If you were to put the rings around the Earth, the rings would stretch out three-quarters of the way to the Moon, which is about 250,000 miles.
Okay, so since the rings are probably the most interesting characteristic, certainly just looking at Saturn for the first time, what's the latest on what's actually caused them? You say maybe a smashed-up moon? I mean, is this just little bits of rock debris?
It's basically made up of bits of debris. It's not known 100% what actually created the rings. The current sort of scientific theories are that a moon was smashed up and the gravitational forces have squashed the debris into this very thin ring. The rings are really thin. In fact, when you look at Saturn, as it goes through its orbit around the Sun, our aspect to it changes, which means that sometimes when you look at Saturn, you can see the full thickness of the rings, and it sort of makes Saturn look like it's got a pair of ears, the way they stick out the side. And then sometimes when the aspect is such, you can't actually see any rings at all because they're a very thin bout, so they're squashed out into a thin bout.
Why is that? Is that because it's somehow the magnetic field of the planet is keeping them squashed?
It's a combination of gravity, the magnetic field. In fact, the magnetic field is quite interesting, because images that have come from a probe, the Cassini probe, which is currently in orbit around Saturn. As she shows these black lines on the rings that are called the spokes, and basically they identify where the magnetic field is within relation to the planet. So it sort of shows you on the rings where the magnetic field is, which is quite an interesting sort of was an interesting discovery that was sort of made with the Cassini probe.
Okay, now I imagine Saturn's pretty nasty if you get down onto the surface. Is it another one of these gas giants like Jupiter? So, you know, we were talking about sending our magic bullet right through it because it's made of gas.
Yeah.
A very intense gas, yes. But nevertheless it's liquid.
Yeah, it is gas. It's 75% of it is helium and the other 25% of it is hydrogen. I mean, it's quite interesting. Saturn has such a low density that if there were an ocean big enough, you'd be able to float it on it.
Crikey. So there's not really rock in the middle of it all.
No, it's all gas.
Is that solidified gas, liquefied gas, or just gas?
It's believed that when the gas in the very centre where the pressures are very high, the gas forms a very complex sort of halfway house between gas, solid and liquid. The physics and chemistry as such I couldn't go into right at this moment.
Well, I mean, it's a little bit like water, isn't it? I mean, water is a gas. When it's in the atmosphere, it's a cloud.
Yeah.
And then it condenses down to a liquid and it's in the sea.
Yep.
And then, of course, it freezes into an iceberg. It's a solid.
Yeah. Obviously, gas, the gas in the centre of the planet isn't frozen like water would be frozen. So, therefore, it doesn't become a solid in that true sense. It becomes, like I say, this very rarefied form of sort of liquid come gas solid.
So is it colder than Earth?
Yeah.
Probably fair to say that most the further out you get in the solar system, the colder it gets.
Yeah, generally speaking, because obviously the amount of energy that's received from the sun is reduced as you go out. The further the distances are, and the temperature at the cloud surface, which is about the most we can measure at the moment, because we've not actually sent a probe into the clouds of Saturn. Is about -177°C.
Oh, a bit chilly, okay.
Yeah, very chilly.
I'll pass on that for my summer holidays.
Yeah, definitely.
Okay, moons. We had lots of moons on Jupiter. Are there as many on Saturn?
Yeah, Saturn's got a fair family of moons. There are 63 known moons.
Crikey.
Yeah, of which 53 are named.
So just remind me, how does that compare with Jupiter?
Jupiter, I believe, has got about 60 known moons.
Okay, so we're roughly
the same, yeah.
About the same size, roughly?
Yeah, Titan is one of the most well-studied moons in the solar system, and is in fact the second largest moon after Jupiter's Ganymede. However, Titan is unusual purely because it actually has... there's only one other place in the solar system that has a nitrogen-rich atmosphere, and that's Earth. And Titan also has a nitrogen-rich atmosphere.
But is it warm enough for us?
No, again, it's a little bit chilly out there. I mean, with the thickness of the atmosphere on Titan, it's quite interesting that it's proposed that with the low... with the low gravitational field on Titan and the thickness of the atmosphere, if humans were to go there, we'd be able to strap wings on and fly, because it's sort of that sort of combination of low gravity. And also, it rains... it's believed that it rains liquid methane on Titan, but again, the gravity is so low that the raindrops sort of float down from the sky. So you'd be able to avoid the drops, effectively, because
they're coming down too slow.
Yeah, they're coming down too slow.
Liquid methane. Liquid
methane smelly. And ethane.
Maybe a bit smelly.
Yes, possibly. again, it's more... I think we smell purely more to do with the atmosphere here on Earth, so I don't know.
Okay, what about images from Saturn of Earth? You know, nice pictures of it, because obviously it's actually one of the most interesting looking planets.
Yeah, a few years ago, the Cassini probe, which, as I've already said, is actually in orbit around Saturn and is doing studies, took an image looking back into the solar system, and in this image was a tiny, almost, it consisted of a few pixels of the image, but it was very bright blue, and it was an image of the Earth, and it's the furthest, it's an image that's been taken from the furthest point we've ever taken an image looking back at Earth. So it sort of gives us this perspective that Earth is basically a little blue gem within the solar system.
Okay, Paul. Next week?
Next week we're doing... I'm going to look at a little bit more in detail about the moons, in particular Titan, and also the rings.
Good. We're slowing down as we're going out, aren't we?
Yeah, we are a little bit. But, Saturn certainly is very interesting with the rings, and Titan is very interesting. As we get out to Uranus and Neptune, we'll speed up a little bit.
All right. Thanks very much, Paul.
Thanks very much, Tony.
That's all for this week. Dialects, a weekly podcast for your MP3 player, produced by volunteers, broadcast on Bristol Community FM 93.2 at 2 o'clock every Friday afternoon. You'll find us online at www.dialectradio.co.uk. And Dialect is a Bristol Broadband Co-op production. Anyone can contribute. If you'd like to, do please contact us through Volunteering Bristol on 0117 989 7733. And you'll find them on the web at bristolvolunteers.org.uk. So that was Dialect. And I'm Tony Gosling, wishing you a very good week. Thanks for listening. Until the same time next week, goodbye.
Amor llega sin esta manera, no tiene la culpa. Caballo le dan sabana porque muy despreciado, por eso no te perdono llorar. Ese amor llega sin esta manera, no tiene la culpa. Amor de compra y venta, amor del pasado. Ven, 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 ven. Perdón de Dios, tú eres mi vida, la fortuna del festín. El destino te desaparado, lo mismo ya callé, lo mismo soy yo. No te encuentro lavando, eres posible, no te encuentro de verdad. Por eso un día no cuento si de nada, lo mismo ya callé, lo pienso en ti.